Stop the Endless Wars. That's the title of a speaking event we recorded on October 1st at Community Church of Boston. The feature was a 30-minute talk by New Jersey activist Madeline Hoffman. Here she is.
My name is Madeline Hoffman, and I'm the director of New Jersey Peace Action based in Bloomfield, New Jersey. I've been the director since August of 2000. And I'm here today because of a number of different things. Over the summer, I spent some time with Ellen Moss, and I was telling her, describing to her what happened to me last year, what I saw when I visited Syria, and then what happened to me when I returned. And Ellen thought that it would make a good topic for a Sunday here at the Community Church of Boston. I will address that, but I want to put it into a larger context of some other things that are going on, and also tie it to or connect it with the work of Massachusetts Peace Action right here in Boston, because I felt it would be a little bit odd to come here as somebody who works in New Jersey and presenting myself to people in Boston without a Boston connection and strengthening the organizing here in Boston. So that's what I'm intending to do. And I want to start out with a little anecdote because I normally don't panic before I speak in different places, but I was panicking this morning because the topic I selected was how to end the endless wars. And when I sat down to try to pull all that together and then to focus on Syria, I said, what am I doing? I mean, we're talking about so many places and so many things. And so I was trying to find a way to pull it all together. And I remembered what happened in my class on Wednesday. I also have been an adjunct professor of political science for 20 years now. And I never intended to be a professor, but all of my hands-on experience and political work in New Jersey led to one position and to another. And so now it's 20 years that I've been teaching. And I teach an American government class on a Wednesday night. And this past Wednesday was very interesting and challenging. In fact, the last couple have been, because I teach in Morris County, New Jersey, which is a predominantly Republican area, and a lot of my students, maybe a third of my class of 15, are pro-Trump. And you really get to see what parts of the Trump rhetoric and propaganda is being absorbed by people who are just growing up and getting welcome to the world of politics. And so we were doing this world's smallest ideological grid, where there were about 10 questions, students answer them, and then they plot where they are on the ideological spectrum. And one of the questions was about whether the students supported a military draft, reinstatement of a draft, mandatory. And to make a long story short, about half the class supported one. Supported no draft, make it continuing it to be voluntary. And then there was another group that said, voluntary, but only if we don't absolutely need a mandatory draft. So we keep it voluntary until there's a need for a mandatory draft. And then I said, well, define that need. When are we there? When would we have a need to implement a mandatory draft? Oh, when we're involved in a world war. And I said, well, what are we doing now? I know, how many wars we're involved in today? And we started to go through the list. Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, Pakistan, Syria, Somalia. Is that enough for a world war? No. That's not enough for a world war. I said, no? Well, then what is enough for a world war? Well, when a major power is involved. Major power. Okay, so what if there's a war with North Korea? Is that enough for a world war? No, not enough. And so we never got to define what was going to be a world war. I said, okay, Donald Trump at the United Nations on September 19th gave this speech where he said he threatened war against Venezuela, he threatened war against Iran by shredding up the Iran agreement, he threatened all this, and behind North Korea is China and Russia. Would that be a world war? And my students just didn't have an answer. So I thought that that's a good way of putting this together, that even with all of those wars going on, students, my students, still don't think that there's a lot of war going on. It's kind of, it's down there, it's underneath, but below the surface, it's not really discussed all that often, at least to them it's not. It's not that the students would support any of those wars, we haven't talked about that specifically, but the perception isn't that we're already involved in all these wars and that any one of these wars could trigger something that would be that important. I'm not arguing for a draft or against a draft with them. I was trying to determine with them, okay, if you think there's a need or that at some point there would be a need for a mandatory draft, when would that be? So going back to Donald Trump's presentation at the United Nations, which I think horrified most of the world and most of the people who listened to it, the fact that he basically said he was willing to destroy North Korea and wipe out 25 million people just like that is an illegal statement from any leader of a sovereign nation against another. And the fact, and illegal under the United Nations Charter, and the fact that he made that statement at the United Nations is even more remarkable because he could have taken advantage of the opportunity he could have. I say that and put that in big, bold letters. Could have taken advantage of the opportunity to talk more about international cooperation and ways in which to work together to solve these issues, which is what the United Nations is all is supposed to be about, not a body that promotes and under and supports these kinds of wars. So it was illegal, totally inappropriate for him to do it, and it's but it's not new policy either. And that's going back to what my student said the other night. These things, these wars I mentioned, were begun under George W. Bush, continued and expanded under Barack Obama. So this isn't new, but it's a time when people feel, I think, and rightfully so, that there's more of an urgency behind all of it because we have someone who's willing to take the curtains off and say blatantly and forthrightly exactly what it is that the United States plans to do. And it's an imperial, it's a agenda of regime change, imperialism, intervention, wherever and whenever the United States decides to do that. And with North Korea, I'm just briefly going to talk about a couple hot spots and then get more into Syria. North Korea, at the same time that 122 nations in July of this year agreed to an international treaty to ban nuclear weapons, which the United Nations and all and the United States and all of the nuclear possessing countries boycotted. The rest of the world says, let's get rid of these, let's ban them, let's never use them. And Trump is talking blithely about using them and destroying an entire nation. And so again, there's another tack that we could be taking that we're not. And so as peace action, we are urging the president and the Congress and everyone in the United States to, they still can sign this treaty. Signing began or opened on the 20th of September. So these two speeches, the one speech and the beginning of the process of signing and ratifying the treaty occurred at pretty much the same time. Signing that treaty, making up for the fact that they and other nuclear possessing countries basically boycotted the negotiations would be something that could happen and make a difference. But we believe that diplomacy is the only way through this crisis, whatever diplomacy is used. And so sanctions are not diplomacy. Increasing and tightening sanctions are not diplomacy. Calling North Korea the aggressor nation in this is not diplomacy. tit for tat, poking one another back and forth is not diplomacy. We need to actually end the Korean War, which never officially ended. We need to give Korea the assurances that they are not going to be attacked by the United States or another external power. And maybe there's a freeze for a freeze here. We'll stop South Korea and United States military actions in return for a freeze on the level of nuclear weapons that that North Korea possesses. Remember, way back when, in the 1990s, North Korea was part of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, but pulled out once George W. Bush called them part of the Axis of Evil. If you're part of the Axis of Evil, what are you going to do? Wait for somebody to come and get you? No, so they pulled out, and this is when a lot of this, a lot of the nuclear development began. Now, we would be more certain to continue pursuing a deal with North Korea if we don't shred up the Iran deal, something else that Trump mentioned at the United Nations. On October 15th, he will have to certify or decertify the Iran deal, which took place after 2.5 years of negotiations, and Iran is apparently in full compliance with it. But Trump wants to shred the deal, calling it the worst deal the United States ever entered into. If it's shredded, then the one model that we've had up there for negotiations in the last 15, 20 years, that will go along with it as well. When we talk about diplomacy with North Korea, at least at this point, we can say, but look, the Iran deal was negotiated. There is no war. We can avert a war through diplomacy and negotiations. If that deal is shredded, then all bets are off. And we'll start again with, should we invade Iran? Should we not invade Iran? Now, all of this, I'm tying it back to the elephant in the living room, I guess, if you want to call it that. I'm not sure. The country of Saudi Arabia. And the country of Saudi Arabia is involved in a couple of different actions in the Middle East. What first that I'll talk about is Yemen. I'll talk about that briefly, and then talk about Syria in the time I have left. Yemen. There's about 20 million people in Yemen now who are in need of aid. They're on the brink of famine. There are 700,000 people with cholera, one of whom dies every hour, I believe, something along those lines. One death per hour from cholera. The country has been devastated environmentally, and the United States has its hands all over it, too. We read about the crisis, and often it's Saudi Arabia doing this, Saudi Arabia doing that. Saudi Arabia is doing it with the full support, material and otherwise, of the United States. The United States sells weapons to Saudi Arabia. The United States has people stationed in Saudi Arabia, in Yemen, rather, at the port of Hodeidah, where a lot of the supplies actually come in to Yemen. We, over the last couple of years, as a peace movement, have gotten more into the minds of the U.S. senators about continuing to support Saudi Arabia through these arms deals, but we haven't been able to stop one of these arms deals entirely. We need to. Saudi Arabia is the... Our alliance with Saudi Arabia is one of the things that needs to break in order to break the cycle of endless wars in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia is also, and now I bring us to Syria here, Saudi Arabia is also funding some of the outside terror organizations, again with the U.S. support, is funding some of the outside terror organizations that have wound up in Syria. And so we hear a lot about this civil war, ongoing civil war in Syria, and I'll just backtrack 1 second. In July of 2016, I went to Syria with a delegation organized by the U.S. Peace Council, and we spent seven days in meetings with a whole variety of people. We wanted to have a delegation that was as broad and diverse as that, where we had conversations with a group as broad and diverse as possible, because we knew coming back to the United States, regardless of what we did, there would be pushback for having gone to that country, even spoken to anybody in the Assad government or Assad himself. And so we met with ministers of health, ministers of labor, ministers of reconciliation, the minister of reconciliation. We met with labor groups. We met with students. We met with people at the University of Damascus. We met with We met with bishops and the Grand Mufti and the Chamber of Commerce and an association of lawyers. And we went to community centers where women were learning to sew and learning how to deal with, cope with the situation that they were facing in their everyday lives, because so many of the men had been killed in the conflict. And so women were dealing with being single, you know, taking care of their children and dealing with literacy issues and everything else. So we met with women actually even some of the children in the orphanages. It was summertime, so most of the residents were gone because it was summer. But there were a few permanent residents at the orphanage whom we had a chance to talk to. They were studying to pass exams that they had failed so they could go from high school to college. We talked to a pilot who worked to bring more food and water into Aleppo because his family was trapped in Aleppo, and he didn't see UN provisions actually getting through to the people in Aleppo who needed it. We talked to members of the opposition party to Assad. We talked to members of parliament, covering a wide range of political parties. In fact, I think Assad's party holds about 51 or 52% of the seats in parliament, and the rest are about 14 or 15 other political parties who are there in parliament. So we tried to get as wide a range of input as we possibly could. And what we heard most often, was one that when the Western media reports that there's a civil war going on in Syria, Western media is incorrect. That it's not this civil war that everyone is saying that it is. It is instead an outside war of aggression that is funded by Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United States, and France and UK are parties to it. And that a lot of the terror, now I use the word terror and terrorism carefully, because in this country you say that and it unleashes a whole host of Islamophobia and anti-Muslim sentiment. I'm not talking about it in that context at all, talking about it as outside groups whose names we'll all recognize. Daesh, which is ISIS, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, and a whole host of groupings under other names, because the names keep changing in order to disassociate with the sources that are funding them. It's a united country. We've also learned that we met with the Grand Mufti, who's in charge of the Islam, and one of his sons had actually been killed by one of these outside terror organizations. And yet he was still talking about reconciliation and peace. We talked with the bishops, and when I asked one person on the delegation, we kind of knew the answer, but I asked, how many Muslims are there and how many Christians are there in Syria? And the answer was unified. We're 23 million Syrians. So we're 23 million Christians, we're 23 million Muslims, you can't divide us that way. And so even the opposition party that had issues with the Assad government about democracy and its constitution and the like, and had been in conflict with the Assad government over some of those measures, when the onslaught began in Syria, they said, well, we have our disagreements with Assad, but in order to protect Syrian sovereignty, we'll put those differences aside, all right, and we'll work together to keep Syria strong. And the U.S. and its presence in Syria was not welcomed and was also described as illegal under international law because, again, Syria is a sovereign country. Whatever you think of Assad, he was duly elected by the people of Syria. And so, once again, as I mentioned with the Trump threat to North Korea, it's in violation of a UN charter to threaten or to attack or intervene in a country just because. And Wesley Clark said it about 7 years prior to this. He said that they gave a list of the seven countries that the United States had in its sights, to places where regime change needed to occur. And then they also said in Syria, they said to a person that Russia's presence was welcome and Russia's presence was legal because Syria had asked Russia to come in, which is also legal under the UN Charter. If your country is attacked and your sovereignty is attacked, you can turn to allies to help you. So Russia was asked, and Russia complied. And some say there that without Russia's support, the Syrian regime would have toppled. And that I don't think the United States and its allies ever thought that Assad would hold on as long as he did. I mean, you look at Libya and Gaddafi. It was a long process, but Syria also looks at Libya and Gaddafi and says, that happened, but look at what happened to them. I was just having a conversation this morning with someone else who had been to Syria last year also. And Syria has a choice. They have a choice between the kind of leader that people have, who is authoritarian perhaps, is war criminal perhaps. We don't know, it's hard from this side to know the range of atrocities he's committed, if any. But the choice is between him, a duly elected, democratically elected, I guess. Can we say that our president was democratically elected? I mean, whatever that means, democratically elected. The other choice is for the outside terror groups, which I mentioned, to be the ones who take over if the regime topples. And so if you're a Syrian citizen, you have those choices. And most of the Syrians back Assad, and back state sovereignty, and back stability of that regime. Or not really, I shouldn't call it regime either. I mean, that was another thing. You say regime, and it sounds like it's illegitimate. It's the Syrian government. You know, all these things considered, there's a reason why there's been pushback, a lot of pushback in Syria, and 6 years later, Syria remains as an independent sovereign nation, and there's still a couple of places within Syria where there's still conflict between these outside forces. Yes, there are people within Syria who have problems with their government, but some of the people I've heard speak or I've heard spoken about say that the solution is whatever local resistance that there is, it's waning, it's on the wane now, and the solution for them is to provide them with weapons so they can defend the democratic process or their revolution. Putting more weapons into that situation, wherever you put them, is not going to make it any better. It's going to be organized chaos, continued organized chaos, which I believe was a term that Hillary Clinton used. You know, in the Middle East, it may be chaotic, but it serves Western ends for there to be that chaos, so that ultimately the countries can be redrawn in the way that serves the United States. So putting more weapons into the area is not the answer. The other thing that we heard about a lot, I didn't know, and I've been working in the peace and justice area as the director of New Jersey Peace Action since the year 2000. I did not know that there have been intense and strict sanctions on the Syrian people. Not UN-imposed sanctions, but I think Britain, Great Britain, France, and the United States imposed sanctions on Syria that are affecting every aspect of Syrian life. From education, for example, when we talk to the people at the University of Damascus. Used to be an exchange, a very active exchange of students from Syria studying in the United States and then coming home, bringing back what they learned, bringing back their knowledge into Syria. That pipeline has been effectively blocked due to the sanctions. And due to the war, the violence, some students can't go to their university of choice in Syria, and the people in the University of Damascus are welcoming them with open arms. Because education is free. Education in Syria is free. Even through medical school, it's not free. It's the equivalent of $50 a year to go to medical school. So it's affecting education. It's affecting business and industry. If a factory, as we met with the Chamber of Commerce, and they told us these stories over and over again, if you can get first you have to make sure you can get the manufacturing equipment to run your factory. Then you have to have somebody come to train you in how to use that equipment. Sometimes they couldn't get the equipment, sometimes they got the equipment, but not the training. And so a lot of the factories were needed to close down or cut back. And that left a lot of people previously employed unemployed. And someone from al-Nusra comes to you and says, I got a way you can make some money here. I'll pay you X number of dollars a day. I know you can't get work in this factory. Here's the money. And so some of the people picking up arms against the Assad government were doing it because of economic concerns. And and the economic concerns are directly related back to the sanctions. And then on health, there was also the sanctions are keeping chemotherapy drugs out for people who need it. They're keeping filters out for dialysis machines. I'm not sure why the filters would be kept out. While we were there, there was a deal with some U.S. pharmaceutical companies to provide immunizations, and the immunizations were not allowed in to the country, and so on. And then lastly, Syria is blocked from being part of international legal organizations because of the sanctions, and therefore, if Syria wanted to make an international case that their rights were being violated, they can't do it because they're not part of the international associations. So, back to Saudi Arabia. The people in the United States need to hold Saudi Arabia accountable. And I was really honored to be invited to speak at a rally by this group called Al-Baqi, which is a group of Shia Muslims in the United States trying to protect a Shia cemetery in Saudi Arabia against Saudi repression. Repression both because they're Shia and wanting to keep not allow Shias to worship freely, but also some of the young women who traveled, the American women who traveled there to go to the cemetery were handled brutally by the Saudis. And so they wanted somebody, Medea Benjamin from Code Pink spoke there 2 years ago. This year I spoke about the role Saudi Arabia plays in the whole Middle East and the U.S. alliance with Saudi Arabia, and how if we can hold them to account and face that, that might be something that relieves some of the pressure on what's going on in the Middle East. Thanks, Kat.
Thanks, Madeline.